get underway. Welcome to the LSE for this evening's event. I am Tarek Barkawi. I'm in the Department of International Relations, and I'll be chairing this event. I'm very pleased to be here to welcome Martin Bailey, Duncan Bell, Rob Johnson, and Yuta Weldes to discuss Martin's new book, Taming the Imperial Imagination, Colonial Knowledge, International Relations, and the Anglo-Afghan Encounter, 1808 to 1878. For those of you who don't know, Martin is an LSE Fellow in Contemporary International Relations at the LSE. Duncan is a reader in political thought and international relations at the University of Cambridge. And Rob is the director of the Changing Character of War Research Center at Oxford University, an associate professor in the Department of Politics and International Relations, and senior research fellow at Pembroke.
Yeah, like all Oxford people, you have three titles.
Duncan, where are your other titles? And Yuta is professor fellow at Christ College. And I'm sure you could come up with another one there if you work on it. And Yuta is professor of international relations at the University of Bristol. Like me, she only has one title. Before we begin, could you please all make sure that your phones are turned down out of your ears so that we don't get interrupted? And for those of you Twitter users in the audience, the hashtag for the evening's talk is hashtag LSE Bailey. As usual, after the presentation and discussion, there will be a chance for you to ask questions. But now, will you please join me in welcoming Martin, Duncan, Rob, and Yuta. We're going to start with a presentation from Martin on the book, and then we're going to have Rob, Duncan, and Yuta get some comments, and then we'll go to a general Q&A from the audience. Martin, take us away.
Great. Thank you, Tarek. One more thing, there are a couple of toilets either side if anyone needs a break, and afterwards the drinks reception will be across the way in the old building. You need to follow the corridor right the way through to the other side,
we'll tell you about
and
that
then there'll be some lifts.
We'll work that out.
I just don't want people to get nervous about the wine at the end. First of all, thank you for coming, and welcome again to LSE. Thanks to Tarek for the introduction. Just a quick few messages of thanks before I get started. Firstly, to Sophie Wives, who's the events coordinator at LSE. She's organized this whole event really, really well with typical efficiency, so thank you to her. I'd also like to thank the LSE IR department, who are funding this event. As Tarek mentioned, I've been a fellow here for 2 years now. And at a time of sort of decreasing opportunities for young academics, I would say that the LSE fellowship program that I'm on is a real savior for people who are trying to get ahead and make a career in academia. If you're at a postdoctoral stage, I highly recommend it, and we also are currently advertising 5 LSE fellow positions in the department. Have a look on the web page if you're interested in them. Downside is you have to work with me.
Martin, we're here for your book. No one here wants to help.
I'd like to thank the panel as well. They have been invited here this evening because through their work they've had a big impact on the way that I've approached my research. So thank you to them. And to you all, of course, for coming. I've tormented many of you with my developing ideas. I assume your presence here is an indication that you are in need of further torment. Either that or I didn't explain myself properly the first time, so I will try one more time. On a cold morning sometime in February 2002 in Wardak province, Afghanistan, a British explorer by the name of Rory Stewart emerged on a road linking the highlands to the capital, Kabul. He was accompanied by nothing more than a backpack, a walking stick, and a large mastiff dog named Babur, after the Mughal emperor whose route he was retracing. The Taliban government had only recently fallen, but pockets of government control remained. Coming across a Taliban checkpoint, Stewart was interrogated on his nationality and then threatened with his life. Adopting the unlikely identity of an Indonesian history teacher, he nonetheless made his escape. Building a life in Kabul, he established an NGO before returning to London, where he now sits in the House of Commons as a Conservative MP. It seems strange to recall now that at the time of Stewart's trip, Afghanistan sat firmly beyond the pale in the popular public imagination. The travel accounts that followed his journey, hailed as a modern classic and swiftly becoming an international bestseller, grabbed the attention of US State Department officials, including Hillary Clinton. Tellingly titled The Places in Between, the book paid homage to the enduring sense of placelessness that has described perceptions of Afghanistan. Whilst his travels in that country helped to make Rory Stewart's career, it underscored the manner in which that country continues to be represented as one of extremes, simultaneously at the confluence of the knowable, of civilizations, empires, nation states, as a roundabout of world history, as Arnold J. Toynbee described it, yet also cast as a backwater, a land of the unknowable, of wild tribes, a domain of rumor, intrigue, and violence, the place where empires go to die. Whilst Rory Stewart's trip was remarkable, as he was well aware, it was far from unique. Beginning in the late 18th and early 19th century, a series of European explorers traveled through Afghanistan and Central Asia, recording their trips, opening up the region to the imperial gaze, and contributing to a vision that would provide the intellectual universe upon which British officials would draw to guide their policy decisions. This book, Taming the Imperial Imagination, takes as its starting point this very body of knowledge. Based on detailed archival research, it's a study into the ways in which powerful states and empires seek to know and understand those parts of the world they consider to be unknown, dangerous, and violent. It shows how this knowledge is produced, reproduced, refined, and put to use in policy decisions. It shows how the British came to know and fear Afghanistan and how it rationalized those fears. Tracing the 19th century origins of the forms of knowledge that inform interventions in Afghanistan and elsewhere today, it challenges those stale narratives of Anglo-Afghan relations that revolve around notions of imperial geopolitical rivalries, the so-called great game between Britain and Russia, instead addressing the crucial question, what did Afghanistan itself mean to the British? The story begins with the traveling exploits of a collection of European explorers, military men, diplomats, and East India Company officials. Now, this map is from about 1832. The borders here are somewhat speculative. Afghanistan sits in the middle here, this sort of pink area, somewhere to the north. Kandahar is about down there. Modern-day Pakistan here and India beyond it. The routes that these individuals took were multiple. Some passed through the Himalayan mountain range up into Central Asia. Those seeking a quick land route from Persia to India headed through the southern deserts of Helmand and Kandahar via the Bolan Pass, or traveling via Kabul itself and the Khyber Pass. The famous explorer and official Alexander Burnes traveled up the Indus River into Central Asia and back down through Persia. Only the most adventurous took the central highland route through the Hazarajat. The motives for these trips was varied and not necessarily limited to any official duties. Many sought fame and promotion, inspired by the 19th century fashion for travel literature, and in some instances urged to locate the mystical Sungi Fars, or Philosopher's Stone, or the fabled lost tribes of Israel, believed to be hidden in the mountains east of Kabul. Others were motivated by the promise of archaeological findings, or even the biblical imagery of the mountains of Afghanistan, thought to be the final resting place of Noah's Ark. These accounts were also diverse in their intellectual influences. Principles of the Scottish Enlightenment, evangelical leanings and the civilizing mission of imperial ideology, or more familiar survey modalities concentrating on land use practices, taxation and revenue yields, all featured. We could view this then as epistemic imperialism, the colonizing of other areas through European forms of knowledge. But this was not the whole story. Journeying into lands well beyond the authority of European rule, these individuals were regularly forced to rely upon local elites, traveling religious notables, merchant communities, or nomadic groups, introducing an important indigenous influence on European understandings. Whilst these accounts often contained pejorative Orientalist tropes, we can also say that European explorers were frequently subject to moments of epistemic insurgency or counter-knowledge. That is, their visions were often shaped by elite opinion, sometimes deliberately, and as such, this was partly a process of interaction and dialogue, an unequal one certainly, but an exchange nonetheless. Britain's initial encounter with Afghanistan was translated through these knowledge entrepreneurs, as I term them in the book. but this was a select group. Counting only Europeans, the number of documented visitors to Afghanistan from 1793 to 1839 numbers just 30. So limited was this knowledge that many of these figures borrowed from one another's work or corresponded in person. This was, as the book argues, an Afghanistan knowledge community. Whilst it's therefore tempting to pass off these works as the antiquated ramblings of a particular breed of imperial chauvinist, the material these figures gathered carries important insights into the ways in which the East India Company and the colonial state familiarized itself with neighboring polities. Their exploits provide a reminder of the essentially disorganized, often unofficial, and sporadic nature of imperial expansion, a process that began with the process of gathering knowledge and information. In November 1838, the largest army ever to have assembled under the Raj gathered in the Punjab in advance of the invasion of Afghanistan. Typically, the First Anglo-Afghan War has been interpreted as a result of British fears of Russian influence in Central Asia. Part two of this book on policy challenges this narrative. Whilst the Russian threat was a dominant theme in London, in India, the most important decisions were made. And here, a more local and regional picture was apparent. The foundations for these understandings were the forms of knowledge that had been developed on Afghanistan prior to the intervention. And a number of early European explorers played a key role in advising colonial officials on their policies. In certain important ways, colonial knowledge in Afghanistan made the First Anglo-Afghan War imaginable in the first place. But this translation from knowledge to policy was not straightforward. This was a process that demanded a series of simplifications to create a legible Afghan polity, one that would be easily understood by colonial officials. And several sites are key in understanding how this process occurred. At Lahore, the aging Sikh ruler Ranjit Singh had taken advantage of the Afghan civil wars of the 1830s to acquire a number of territories previously under Afghan control. The viability of East India Company's commercial interests demanded a reconciliation of these disputes. To the west, Persian troops were besieging Herat from the late 1830s, events which were watched with growing alarm by British representatives in Tehran, whose communications back to London were far more rapid through the diplomatic channels of Constantinople. Do you guys want to move over here? Yeah. There's sort of a bit bunching going on here. I want to make you uncomfortable.
There's more tables to sit on. Someone should take that chair.
This chair does that too.
Yeah, and there's a couple chairs in the middle, so just take a couple minutes to let you guys all... A couple chairs over here that you can pull out. We apologize. Oh, it's very hard to get a big room at LSE in the evening. I think it bodes well for the book's success. Okay.
Where were we? Oh, the Persians besieging Herat. British representatives whose communications through Constantinople were getting back to London much quicker. In Kabul, the early Afghanistan explorer Charles Masson, now under the employment of the government of India, forwarded news updates on the Afghan ruling court. He was joined in 1837 by Alexander Burnes, who sent one of his mission to Kandahar to report back on the ruler who was known to be opposed to the rule of the Afghan emir, and rumored to be instigating an attack on Herat with the support of Persia. These reports were filtered through Ludhiana, where an ambitious official named Claude Wade sought to present the former king, Shah Shuja, in a favorable light, encouraged by Shuja and his followers who were in exile there. Meanwhile, Peshawar was presenting a further flashpoint as the Afghan emir made attempts to reclaim the territory from the Sikhs in 1837. Partly as a result of this information order, the British increasingly viewed Afghanistan as a polity made up of fractured city-states, Kabul, Kandahar, and Herat, leading the Governor General of India to refer to the triple power of Afghanistan. But a deeper schism underpinned this simplified vision. Based on the earlier ethnographic and historical knowledge of Afghanistan explorers, the British increasingly viewed the competing tribal federations of the Barakzai and the Sadrazai as central to understanding internal Afghan instabilities. The exiled Sadrazai king, Shah Shuja, was increasingly painted as the rightful ruler of a throne that had been stolen from the ruling Barakzai elites. The previously fluid and expansive colonial knowledge of earlier explorers was thus evolving into what Tarak has called elsewhere a policy science for the powerful, contributing to what Jutta Welders terms quasi-causal representations. This was a process of closure, one that shut down latitude for interpretation and elided the complexities and nuances of the Afghan political community, complexities that had only ever partially been understood. The disasters of the First Anglo-Afghan War had a critical impact on Anglo-Afghan relations, rendering them moribund for over 10 years and effectively closing Afghanistan off to European explorers and officials. So we're going to move on to, this map is now 1901, so a little bit later than the period that I'm looking at in the book. But you can see here the Punjab region, this is Kelat, which was annexed in the late 1870s. This red kind of outline here is what was known as the Northwest Frontier Province, and this is Afghanistan to the north. Part three of this book is labelled Exception and takes the woefully neglected period of Anglo-Afghan relations after the First Anglo-Afghan War seriously, charting three principal dimensions shaping these relations. First, there was the emergence of a violent geography, one that was frequently linked to Afghan character, putting a newly pejorative spin on the existing corpus of colonial knowledge and providing a reminder of the intimate connection between Orientalist sentiment and war. Seeking to atone for their brutal ejection from the country, British officials placed Afghans firmly beyond the pale of civilized international society. This was a narcissistic reflex serving an emotional need, but the fear and paranoia of Afghanistan as a threat to the defense of India was also encouraged by the somewhat improvised means by which the British kept themselves informed of Afghan affairs. A series of what Chris Bailey has termed information panics gripped frontier officers stationed in the recently annexed Punjab, often revolving around rumors of Afghan subterfuge and pan-Islamic conspiracies emanating from Kabul. Secondly, there were the wider visions of global order. The designation of Afghanistan as an uncivilized state, sustained and justified by colonial knowledge, merited its exclusion from international society on legal grounds too. Uncivilized states were viewed as incapable of engaging in diplomatic reciprocity and were placed in a separate normative universe, thus sanctioning exceptional measures and a general derogation from the established practices of interstate conduct. This was critical in understanding great power relations. In fact, in stark contrast to most of the histories that exist on this period, the book shows how Britain and Russia often cooperated over the management of Central Asian polities, viewing the task as a shared duty of so-called great powers and civilized states. Thirdly, were the bureaucratic processes that accompanied an increasingly assertive military presence on the frontier. This provided a panacea to the paucity of information coming from the north, as Afghanistan was reduced to a problem of military science. Whereas previously the idea of Afghanistan was dominated by the works of European explorers and company men, a new community of expert knowledge dominated by the military began to capture definition of the problem. The scientific frontier, as it was known, sought to establish the most efficient means for the defense of India's northwest through a system of garrisons, telegraph links, and railway lines. Elsewhere, competing systems of frontier population control became the subject of an intense policy debate. Enabled by new modes of transport and communication, imperial experts began to craft a more generic, ordered, systematized, even scientific solution to policy problems. As the colonial state moved into a higher gear of mass information management, the solution to the Afghanistan question began to resemble similar frontier management tasks in South Africa, North Africa, Central Asia, and Europe. The imperial imagination had been tamed. As this book shows, knowledge was a key edifice of colonial power and imperial power and control. But for IR in particular, colonial knowledge challenges some of the central concepts we hold dear to our field, demonstrating their historical, geographical, and cultural contingency. Afghanistan provides just one example. Sovereignty was ambiguous, appearing to be divided amongst groups, existing in genealogical idioms of tribe, religious idioms of Islam, and regal idioms of rule. Territoriality was vague, where Afghanistan lay remained contested throughout much of the 19th century, as officials struggled to comprehend the apparently expanding and contracting authority of successive Afghan rulers. The concept of state was similarly vague, often embodying more familiar notions of governmental apparatuses, but as Duncan Burl's work highlights, also slipping into more moral or metaphysical understandings, including nation, tribe, body politic, or commonwealth. Embedded in this knowledge was a fluid, normative conception of the Afghan polity viewed through the European lens. Attention to knowledge, therefore, offers new insights on inter-polity relations, particularly those between powerful states or empires and the regions they consider to be distant or unknown. Taming the imperial imagination also marks a major contribution to those works that have sought to recover the value of imperial history in the study of international relations. Rather than taking empire as a state writ large, it interrogates the precise operation of imperial expansion and dissolves misleading and Eurocentric notions of inter-imperial rivalries as the defining story of international history in the non-West. It draws attention to the broader imperial ideologies and visions of global order that justified imperial endeavors and shows how these were sustained by colonial knowledge that empire relied upon. Rather than relegating Afghanistan to the margins of global history, this book brings Afghanistan into British imperial formations in India, showing center-periphery distinctions rested upon cultural formations as well as the shift in economic and military power from east to west. Finally, through this book, we can also turn an analytical eye on the contemporary forms of knowledge that guide foreign interventions today. Whilst the discourse of civilized and uncivilized states may have faded, in its place we have the language of failed states, rogue states, and ungoverned space. In turn, we have projects of modernization theory, development theory, state building, and post-conflict state reconstruction, all of which Afghanistan has been subject to. These generic, flattening visions of progress have prompted some to call for a revival of the cultural understanding of empire, our opening character, Rory Stewart, amongst them. Indeed, one of the striking developments of the post-9/11 era has been the reactivation of colonial forms of knowledge in pursuit of counterinsurgency, counterterrorism, and state building. However, this nostalgia for empire overlooks one of the key findings of this book, that 19th century Afghanistan experts were just as partial to the prevailing intellectual fashions and to the cultural bias of their heritage as we are today. Furthermore, as this book shows, when this knowledge becomes adapted to a policy agenda, it necessarily becomes warped, schematic, and simplified. This process seems inescapable. Understanding how this might happen requires an approach that is appreciative of the sociology of knowledge becoming rather than simply being. This is an insight, it seems, that can inform policy as much as it can inform the discipline of international relations. Thank you.
Commentators who will offer some brief praise and criticism and thoughts for everyone to think about, and then we'll go to Q&A in the audience. Rob, please.
Well, good evening and salam alaikum. I've been given strict instructions to be no more than about 5 minutes, so I'm going to try and squeeze in a response in about 5 minutes. Martin's quite rightly helped us to understand that this book is about understanding how the British thought about and understood Afghanistan in the 19th century, flawed though that was. And he's explained already that this was part intellectual history, part international history, and part, strangely, international relations. And he gives us a very comprehensive review and critique of the literature, well, the best, actually, I have to say, I've read about the literature of Afghanistan in recent times, highlighting that knowledge is constructed, how we have seen through the lens of the 19th century, polities, peoples, borders, indeed even events in Afghanistan. And he offers two particular criticisms, which he sort of just touched on there, the idea that IR, for example, international relations, has rather instrumentalized history, squeezed into a box, stripped it of its meaning, just to sort of make a point about theory, and missed out the all-important empire aspect of international relations. The world of 1900, at the end of his period of study, was a world of empires, not of nation-states. And he offers a very severe criticism, actually, of the Great Game, which I took personally. So I'm a bit about the subject. Merely saying that it is not this Great Game, merely a struggle. We shouldn't see Afghanistan as merely a struggle of British and Russian geopolitics. So what are my responses? Well, first of all, I think it's this extraordinarily well-researched history of the interactions between the British and the Afghans, whoever they may be. And also, it is a fantastic example of how you can take intellectual history, make it intrinsically interesting for our understanding of the official mind of Britain in the 19th century. Of course, the difficulty we always have is deriving which interpretations and which influences in the 19th century in the official mind were the ones that drove the policy, because this is a very much contested series of ideas in Britain and in India. Now, I've got three areas that I thought I might just quickly touch on in the book, because there are many interesting ones. One is about policy. One is about the Great Game, stand by Martin. And the other one is about Afghans, because I'm slightly worried that they get a little bit relegated. So I'm going to be a little bit critical and push back a bit, but bear with me. First of all, on policy. The problem we have as historians, as international relations theorists, as people who work on political science, as scholars generally, is what weight do we give to particular policies or particular interpretations compared with the events that are actually unfolding? Now, that sounds a bit abstract, so let me give you an example. Afghanistan had a series of civil wars in the 1860s, as Martin explains in his book, that the British decided made Afghanistan unstable. I think that's indisputable, that was the case, that they were right in their interpretation. But the British then extend that interpretation to say, well, this instability makes Afghanistan, whatever that area is, vulnerable to intervention by a rival. And that is the bit that was contested then in the 19th century and is, in many ways, is contested even today. So we have to decide what was established truth at the time, what was uncertain to contemporaries, what was open to interpretation, and what was constructed to justify some particular policy line. This might feel resonant today, and what was simply misunderstanding, which also has some resonance today. And what it leaves us with is that decisions of the past give us some indication about decisions we've just seen made over the last 20 years. Decisions about Afghanistan made after 9/11/2001 and subsequently reveal all of the problems of what's true, what's misunderstood, what's interpreted, what's uncertain, all of those occurring all at the same time. It's not just that one is deriving a policy line, they're all going on at once. And that the one of the big problems that Martin identifies is quite what this territory, Afghanistan, really was, how do you define it, how did the British define it at the time, and he uses the word sovereignty quite a lot in the book, which is very interesting. I would simply suggest we ought to use the word legitimacy as much as we use the word sovereignty. So I think that will give you some interesting areas, and you might want to think about that as a response. Now, on this issue, finally, of policy, I would say this, that policymakers, when we look at who these people actually are, recent events have indicated that there is a significant distinction between military decision-makers and civilian ones, as well as contested within those two groups. If you only compare, for example, the memoirs of Cheryl Cooper Coles over the recent conflict in Afghanistan with that of Chris Elliott, who's just written on high command, General the Lord Richards taking command, and Richard Iron and Jonathan Bailey's edited volume on Blair's Wars and Britain's Generals, just those four texts alone will give you some indication of just how contested policymaking really is between these different groups. So this brings me to the next area on policy, which is the second point I'd like to make about the Great Game and how policymakers really interpreted what was going on. Martin quite rightly asked the question, why is it, if this whole thing was fake, this great game, why was it so persistent in the narratives and the literature of the period? Was it simply used as a rhetorical device to justify a series of policy decisions that were being made? And Martin's very critical of the way that great game studies have gone on being perpetuated by scholars long after the British left in 1947 from South Asia. And he argues that this phrase should be brought to an end because it's become really all things to all men. And it's obscured what he thinks is a much more important issue, and I don't blame him for saying this, a much more important issue, which is the conditions that were facing the populations of South Asia rather than this geopolitical rivalry between Britain and Russia, which was settled frankly in the capitals anyway, certainly by 1907 or 1914. He points out, as he did a moment ago, the cooperation that occurred between Britain and Russia over Persia, rather like, you might say, Soviet and American cooperation over the Middle East in the Cold War. He also points out, as we know from the studies of people like Arthur Connolly in the early 19th century, that the Great Game or the Grand Game was merely a way of explaining the moral imperative to extend Western civilization, as so-called the 19th century people thought. Now, the problem I've got, the reason why I'm pushing back a little bit, not even because I have a vested interest in making my books continue to sell on the Great Game, is that geopolitical rivalry was an established historical issue. I mean, it really was there. We can explain it away as constructivism and so on, but in the end, there really was a rivalry between Britain and Russia, just as there was a rivalry between Britain and France over aspects of Africa, and Germany later on as a latecomer to that whole debate in the late 19th century and early 20th century. But what I find really fascinating about your book is that Afghanistan represents the limit of the project of either great game politics, geopolitics, or more importantly, the British imperial project, which you identify. It's the limit of empire. That's what makes Afghanistan so interesting. Consent or compliance, which they got in South Asia, they didn't get in Afghanistan. The scientific military frontier that was invented in the end of the 19th century, which you refer to in the book, represented the inability to hold dominion over eastern Afghanistan at a reasonable cost. So it's a negative limit of empire. There's also something else. There's a positive limit of empire here. There's a voluntary limit that was imposed by the British themselves. And it's a simple fact that Britain was a major maritime power. We are fish, Lord Salisbury once said. We're a maritime power. It was a maritime power with, actually, I'm coming to know, with continental liabilities, which sought to limit the costs of occupation of empire voluntarily. And I just venture to say, as a sort of footnote to that, 1873 is a real watershed, actually, that appears in the book. Final point, then, the Afghans themselves. Now, I'm being slightly unfair if I say he missed them out. Of course he doesn't. They feature throughout the book, the Afghans. And I think, you know, we need to acknowledge that what Martin's doing is writing a book about the British views of the Afghans. He's not writing a book about the Afghans themselves. So let's be careful about this. But he does expostulate an idea in the book, of understanding what Afghanistan itself meant to the British. That's a very laudable thing to attempt to do. There is something I would suggest we might do, and that's to ask the opposite question. What did the British mean to the Afghans? What use did the British have for the Afghans? Were they a cash source to avoid imposing taxation? Martin mentions this in his book. Was it expertise to help with governance? They tried to attract Charles Masson at one point, the deserter from the East India Company, to help them with running a particular district. Was it a counterweight to Russia or to Persia? Did the British represent a source of armaments, a tool against internal rivals, a means to achieve hegemony over the peoples of Afghanistan? I wonder what it was. But we do know there are examples, both in the 19th century and indeed in the 1919 Third Anglo-Afghan War, which the Afghans initiated, that they felt that the British served a purpose for their own political ends internally. And on the question of being known, we should be very careful about one thing. That is that the people of Central Asia and South Asia knew the Afghans all too well and what they were like and their reputations, because the Afghans were a very well-connected polity or series of polities on the old Silk Route. They were very well-established, they were well-known, and they were distributed far and wide with a diaspora long before the 19th century, as you know. So let me conclude the last 5 seconds or so before Tarek cuts me off. And that's simply to say, this is a great book. It's bravely interdisciplinary. It gives you a very excellent study of the role of knowledge and understanding and how flawed they were in the 19th century as well as successful. How ideas were, and indeed are, created and reinforced and take on an importance out of all proportion to that which was meant sometimes at the time. And how these moments of understanding are really contingent on historical and factual events. I would recommend something. That is, we take Martin's model of approaching history and international relations and apply it to an understanding of how the British viewed Arabia, the Greater Syria, and indeed Ethiopia, because I think the results will be very, very interesting indeed. Well done.
For Martin's future PhD students there.
Thanks very much. I'll start by thanking Martin for inviting me to come and give a few words on his book. It's a pleasure to read, and I would definitely recommend it following Wolf's suggestions. Now, I'm not an expert on Afghanistan or imperial history in South Asia, so I'm not going to be able to say much about that. I'm going to reflect a bit more on the relationship, as Martin asked me to, of history and IR. In very, very general terms. So IR was born as a discipline of empire, as in part an imperial science dedicated to the maintenance of global white supremacy. The least IR today could do, I would suggest, is to take empire seriously as one of the central organising forms of world history, and as something whose shadow continues to shape many of the knowledge practices as well as political forms in which and through which we live. Of course, in recent years, a number of IR scholars, I was thinking of Tarek here amongst others, have done important work in bringing empire back where it originally was, albeit in a very different sense, to the heart of IR. And I would read Martin's book as an important contribution to that exercise and to be commended greatly for it. So with that in mind, I'm just going to say something about, not about IR, which I think we'll talk more about, but about how history or historians might read Martin's book. Because as Rob said, it's a bravely interdisciplinary book. It's pitched at IR, but also at imperial history. It draws on theories, conceptual frameworks, disciplinary literatures from a variety of places. And I'm going to mention briefly three subfields, loosely defined, of history, where I think that Martin's book should, and I hope does, find a reception, because it speaks to some prominent issues that are being discussed in them today. And those subfields are broadly imperial stroke world history, the history of the human sciences, and intellectual history. And I'll start with imperial history. So in my experience, imperial historians don't really read IR. The international historians, I know some of them read a bit of IR theory, often quite traditional in kind. They know they're realists from the liberal internationalists. But imperial historians, often nowadays relabeled world historians, who are amongst the most theoretically sophisticated of historians, very well versed in theory, cultural theory, social theory, aspects of political theory, very rarely engage at all with IR theory. And we might ask questions about why that is, whether it's a form of parochialism amongst the historians, or whether there's something simply off-putting or uninteresting about IR theory. But I do hope that Martin's book will help to break that mould, because I do think that it's of considerable value to imperial historians. And so, good luck with that. I mean that in a positive way. Imperial history itself has changed a lot in the last couple of decades, and that does provide an opening, I think, for this kind of work. The field once divided very fiercely along political and methodological lines, the two often intersecting, or being conflated. Has led recently to more interesting alliances and to some calming of tempers and positions. The centre of that shift stood the late, great Chris Bailey, one of the two dedicatees of Taming the Imperial Imagination, and a towering presence in its pages. Whereas once adherents of the so-called Cambridge School of Imperial Historiography faced off against the radical insurgence of subaltern studies and multiple other schools and traditions, a new sense of rapprochement has appeared in the last couple of decades, and it's increasing further. Deepesh Chakrabarty, in an affectionate portrait of Chris Bailey published very recently, suggested that the grounds for this rapprochement, for this convergence of positions within imperial and world history, was on the terrain of the study of political ideologies. A shared interest, an emerging shared interest, in how ideas and their power as well as the social and political context in which those ideas were articulated, helped to shape imperial formations and continue today to shape our politics. Now, this study of ideologies can, of course, take many different forms, and it does, but one of the central ones has been the study of colonial knowledge, not in itself new, but becoming ever increasingly significant. From Bernard Cohen's seminal Colonialism and Its Forms of Knowledge, through Chris Bailey's Empire and Information, and many studies between both those books playing a significant role in taming the imperial imagination. Martin's excellent account of reconstruction of the intertextual empire of Afghanistan, the way in which the multiple travellers' tales and their readings and rereadings formed this imaginary of Afghanistan, can be seen as a very important contribution, I think, to this literature, and hopefully will be of interest to imperial historians, who of course have done this for other parts of the empire, but far less so for Afghanistan. And Afghanistan as a state is an unusual case because of its liminality, its peculiarities, its, in some sense, unknowability, as it was considered at the time, as opposed to other parts of the empire where the ignorance may be as high, but the belief in superiority and knowledge was much different. So Martin's book then can be read both as a reflection of these shifts in imperial history and as a significant contribution to them. Hopefully it will encourage those imperial historians to begin to read IR a bit more than they've done in the past. I'll move to the history of the human sciences. I'll speak briefly about this and briefly about history of political thought. The history of human sciences is at the moment one of the most popular fields in historical writing. It's focused much on the 20th century, history of psychology, history of anthropology, so on and so forth. And I think that Martin's book can be read again very productively in this discourse. Its contribution to this literature, much of the early work on this vein from the 1960s onwards, represented perhaps reductio ad absurdum by Noam Chomsky's work, focused in a rather one-dimensional sense on the complicity of social sciences and the project of empire from the 19th century to the Cold War and onwards. The most recent wave of historical work in the last decade or so has tended to complicate this rather reductionist picture, painting in rather more subtle colours, of course never denying the complicity, that would be a crazy thing to do, but suggesting that there were other things going on too, that the connection wasn't quite as unidimensional and simple-minded. So while the social sciences have been entangled, forms of knowledge produced sometimes under the auspices of empire and sometimes on its edges have sought to challenge and undermine, complicate those very narratives, and did at the time too. And I read Martin's own narrative about the ways in which colonial knowledge was produced in the 19th century as in part that. But it's got a temporal dimension too. The much messier picture becomes over time in his analysis a much more simple one as military science begins to predominate and the traveller's tales produced by people often not in the service of empire and whose knowledge was instrumentalised but could only be partially so, begins to give way to policy science at roughly around the same time as the discipline of international relations emerges as this science of colonial administration. It's an interesting aspect that's kind of left hanging at the end of Martin's book, and which I know he's interested in pursuing in further work, but there's a tailing off point now which is worth thinking much more about. I'm thinking here of another book recently read, Eric Lindstrom's Psychology and Empire, for those of you who are interested in this recent literature on production of colonial knowledge. There's of course an IR dimension to this too, in the scholarship on the history of the historiography of IR empire, which I've already alluded to, from Brian Schmidt to John Hobson to most recently, I think most significantly, Bob Vitalis's recent work. And Martin's book gives in a sense a prehistory of this. That's always focused on the 19th, or the late 19th century and onwards through the 20th century. The actual discipline of international relations. What we find in Martin's work is the kind of prehistory to that. This is not a discipline of international relations, but this is the intellectual world of colonial administrators, of officials, of intellectuals, writing about the international and the imperial, and it provides a very important and interesting context for thinking about the later emergence of the formal discipline of IR. Finally, the history of political thought, my own, I guess, main field, and it's here that I'm going to have the least to say. It just strikes me that, again, there's a very important contribution that can be made by this kind of work. It's not a traditional study in the history of political thought by any means. There are very few, if any, canonical figures in it, and insofar as they do appear, it's to provide a kind of background to the people that are the main study. But I think that this kind of middle-range intellectual history, we might call it, the study of public intellectuals from the time who are forgotten now, of colonial administrators of significant scholarly interest, of educated and intelligent policymakers in London, writing books, writing articles, is vital to understand if we're to try and at least work through visions of world order and an empire that were produced in the imperial metropole. We don't get an adequate picture at all just by studying John Stuart Mill or Henry Sidgwick or whoever else, important as that might be. We need to study these lesser intellectuals because in many ways they were far more significant in the shaping of policy and in the shaping of colonial knowledge. And so I think that Elphinstone in particular, who figures at the very centre of Martin's narrative, should be a set figure for studies of 19th century British intellectual history, although his books are pretty hard to get going, as we said. And so I think that there is a case to be made for seeing this as, in many things, as amongst other things, a study in the history of political thought, but a kind of history of political thought in action, as ideas move through the institutions and are and you know, sometimes do and sometimes don't have effects of the kind that Rob said are actually very hard to pin down, which is what makes this work both essential but also very difficult to execute. And I think, in conclusion, that Martin's done an excellent job in doing so, and I would encourage you all to read the book when you get a chance. Thank you.
One of Martin's taglines is that IR has to do its own histories, and not just rely on historians for them.
I get a t-shirt with that
written on it. Yes, I like it. Utah.
Thank you. I wanted, first of all, to thank Martin for inviting me to discuss his book. And I wouldn't have read it otherwise, and I only because I'm an old-fashioned IR kind of scholar, and I don't do this sort of empirical subject. I'm a, if I do any history, it's the U.S. Cold War foreign policy history, and so this is outside of my area in that regard. And I wouldn't have read it, therefore... but I would encourage you to read it because it's absolutely terrific. Despite its rather imposing title, it's really engaging, really lively written. It's written in a really lively way. It's absolutely lovely. So I would just encourage you to read it. What I want to do in the few minutes I have is to kind of change the register of discussion a little bit. Because I come from IR and foreign policy studies a bit, I want to highlight a particular theoretical issue that came up for me in reading the book. So it's not, my comments aren't about the book as a whole. They're about a particular sort of theoretical issue that arose for me that I think Martin raises, that I think he says interesting things about, and that I think that I was prompted by the book to ask that we think further about. So it wasn't that I'm asking Martin to do that, but that I think it's a wider issue that we, as a community of scholars, need to think about. So I want to say first, what does Martin do? Then I want to say what's good about that, and then I want to say where could we go? Okay, so most simply, what I think a central part of what Martin is arguing in his book is to ask the question of how what he calls the amorphous and contested idea of Afghanistan, broadly understood and from lots of sources, but this amorphous idea of Afghanistan, how that is first of all constructed, and then secondly and very importantly, how it provides the understandings that shaped and guided British policy decisions about that region during the time period that he lays out. So in a very straightforward way, it's about how this idea of Afghanistan leads to policy, right, outcomes. And that's the sort of nexus that I'm interested in because of my own work and my own background. So I think in unpacking the two part or thinking explicitly about those two parts of the question, which isn't all he's doing, but the bit I'm focusing on, in looking at those two questions, we can see that in some ways he approaches the two halves of that question in quite distinct ways. And I'm oversimplifying massively because it's a really complex analysis, but I'm trying to make a point. So I'm oversimplifying. So we get this idea of the idea of Afghanistan guides British foreign policy. And the first part of that analysis on the idea of Afghanistan is very heavily a kind of constructivist, to use an awkward language. It's a very heavily sort of constructivist argument that says that Afghanistan as an idea is constituted socially, culturally, in different ways, out of a lot of different sources. And he argues specifically, drawing on Said's kind of Orientalist language, that Afghanistan is an imagined entity, right? And so then drawing on a variety of other sort of constructivist and post-structural scholars like Simon Dalby's idea of tabloid realism, and the idea of a cartography of danger that's constituted in producing a particular kind of Afghanistan. He draws on language like narratives and and representation and so on to produce a very constructivist kind of analysis of the first part of the problem, the idea of Afghanistan, and makes very overtly constitutive arguments as opposed to causal arguments. So they're arguments about how we constitute the world that we engage in, these policymakers and all the other people who contribute to this idea. Okay, so you get, on the one hand, this very constitutive kind of language and kind of argument from a particular sort of epistemological position. And the second half of the argument, or the other part of the argument that I'm focusing on, is this idea that British policy is guided by that, by this idea, this amorphous idea of Afghanistan. And I think that my slightly maybe critical comment is I think that that bit is a little bit less overtly theorized and less theorized it's not theorized in as much detail, but it focuses on this really interesting idea of policy closure, where he talks about the creation of a definitive, over time, the creation of a definitive interpretation of Afghanistan, which then leads to particular policies. Okay. In the discussion of that maneuvering over time to get these amorphous ideas of Afghanistan into a kind of definitive construction of what it looks like, he offers a whole set of causal arguments as opposed to constitutive arguments, or at least that's how I was reading the book. So in particular, chapters 3 and 4, really detailed analyses of the way in which different kinds of causal factors and causal mechanisms lead to what he calls policy closure, or this creation of a definitive understanding, at least temporarily definitive, so that you get British policy decisions made on that basis. And in the in that discussion, I'll just give you some examples. In that discussion, he lays out a whole slew of different kinds of causal arguments and causal mechanisms. So he draws on institutional policymaking structures. So he talks about how existing policy programs actually filtered in and out aspects of those ideas about Afghanistan so that some went out the window and some got focused in and more attention paid to. He brings in, as a causal factors, other ideas about the Russian threat and so on. He brings in ideas about British trade interests. He brings in arguments about treaty structures and the practices of treaty negotiations and how they impacted on this construction of this idea. He brings in decision-making rules, for example, erring on the side of who they knew best. Yeah, that was one of the rules. He even brings in really sort of individual level factors like personal jealousies between different kinds of actors. So there's this incredibly rich array of causal arguments and causal mechanisms brought into the second half of the argument about the creation of policy closure so that you can draw a policy conclusion. We must go to war, or whatever the policy conclusion is. And one of the things that I was really intrigued, and I think that the book does incredibly well, is to illustrate, in the way he presents the history of this stuff, to illustrate the back and forth that goes on between the kind of developments in the constitutive arguments, how we construct Afghanistan, how we understand it, and how that changes over time, in connection to these causal mechanisms, these really diverse kinds of causal mechanisms. And that's laid out in what I would, as an IR, one of these bad abstractor people, as an IR scholar, what I think the historians do really well is to tell a story about this and to tell it as a narrative that really kind of makes a lot of sense when you're reading it. So I thought that was really great. And I think that's really interesting. I also think, though, and that what piqued my interest theoretically from a point of view of IR theory was that the analysis does a really interesting job of combining what we typically, in IR at least, gets left as very discrete kinds of approaches. We typically have people who do constitutive kind of analyses and we have people who do causal kinds of analyses, and nobody ever puts those together. And in fact, the constituted people hate the causal people, and vice versa. There's a couple of moments of the causal people hating the constituted stuff left in your book, by the way. I should point those out later. So I thought it really did just an interesting job of both showing that in a narrative fashion and raising that combination as a theoretical kind of project. Okay. And so to me, what the book really contributes to somebody with my interests is this overt thinking of those two kinds of kind of epistemological questions about how we explain stuff and putting those together so that the causal and the constitutive come together in this narrative. Now, the one bit that I am a bit more hesitant about, and where I think it's not for you to have done this because you've already done a massive amount of stuff in the book, but what it raises for me is the question of, I don't think just telling the story as a convincing narrative does enough to theorize how we think the causal and the constitutive together. Do you know what I mean? So putting them together in a narrative story doesn't necessarily tell us theoretically how they go together in the different specific instances, right? So I'm not entirely persuaded that we have enough in the book about, just as a last example, for example, how do we put together at a theoretical level the argument that you have the constitution of these ideas about Afghanistan in discourse, a discursive constitution, the absence of the word discourse is striking. But how does that fit with all the cognitive language? So part of your causal argument going on is a cognitive argument, or a set of cognitive arguments about the way in which people believe things and so on. And you talk about cognition, you talk about perceptions, you talk about quote-unquote narrative forms that exist in the cognitive senses, instruments of the mind. And those belong to an utterly different causal kind of theoretical perspective than does all the constituted theorizing that you do about the idea, about the construction, the constitution of the idea of Afghanistan. So to me, as a theory person who wants to ask those kind of questions, I want to see us as a community do more work about how do we unpack the connections between the constitutive and the causal that are really well illustrated in your narrative analysis.
More work there for Martin's future PhD students. Okay, I think what I'm going to do now, since you all have been patiently listening, is take maybe two or three comments, questions, thoughts from the audience, and then come back to Martin and allow him to respond to your questions as well as some of the things that anything he has to say to the other panelists. Would you like to start us off? Go for it.
Hi, Martin. Thanks and congratulations for getting as close as you can get to being a historian, but I'm
some of us aren't envious.
I'm wondering if your ideas of sort of British conceptions of Afghans and Afghanistan, how much or to what extent are the Afghans aware of this sort of imagination process, instrumentalize it to create images of themselves that are beneficial to whatever it is they're trying to accomplish?
Thank you. I saw another hand over here. Please.
Yes, hi, my name is Lutfullah. I just had a very quick question. I'm not sure if you have made any reference to the legacy of the empire from that time in the form of the Durand Line and how that has a negative impact between the relationship between Afghanistan and Pakistan. And my second question is, that's from the gentleman on the right, sorry, I mixed your names. You mentioned that previously Britain was not honest. I mean, they made Afghanistan unstable. Do you think that they are now honest in their foreign policy towards Afghanistan? Because we did have certain steps, like the government tried to install Paddy Ashton in Afghanistan, who wanted to divide Afghanistan into eight different zones or whatever that was. So it would be great if you can talk about that.
One more. Go for it.
Thank you. First, that you talked about how the Afghans saw the British at that time, whether as cash machine or expertise or some other options. My understanding is that we considered the British as a threat, first of all, more than anything else. And then along that spectrum, there were other things that we played along that policy. To Martin, you thought about the gap in understanding of Afghanistan, the difference in how the civilians understood Afghanistan and how the military in India understood it, and the seriousness of the threat by the Russia was one good example. Do you think the international community still suffers from that menace? Is there an understanding between how the military people look at it and how academics or college?
Thank you. Thank you, everyone, also for being concise in your comments. I'm going to let Martin give some remarks now. Martin, I think you should feel free to respond as well to the panelists. So take some time to say what you want, and then I'll come to any thoughts that the panelists may have, and then I'll come back to all of you.
Thank you. Thanks for all of those comments. As usual, I wish I was able to articulate what I'm actually trying to do as well as you have. I'll respond to those audience questions first, and then I'll come back to the panel points. Firstly, how aware were the Afghans of British representation, Jonathan? So one of the things that is tantalising, but I was never able to really get good empirical data on or insight into, is precisely this question. I think you can see, as I suggested in my talk and in the book, I talk a little bit about this idea of epistemic insurgency, the notion that knowledge is always a sort of a public commodity, and those that you are seeking to know about know what you know about them and will use that against you sometimes if they want. And that has resonances right up to this day in the form of the Taliban as an organization. Mike Martin's book has talked about this. I think one of the interesting things in this period of history is the taxation regimes that were deployed, particularly on the frontier, and the fact that with a taxation regime, you're basically instructing people to act in a certain way for monetary gain, and they will then act in that way. So in this sense, the knowledge that you generate and the policies that you implement on the basis of that knowledge starts to create the world that you see. In summary, in answer to your question, I can't give you a good answer because I don't have the Persian, the diary sources, or the Pashto sources, indeed. And I really hope that something that's printed in this work is that someone will actually come and do some decent work on this area. The Durand Line, it's an interesting sort of part of this history, but it's beyond the period that I focus on. The Durand Line is 1893, I think. Right, Rob?
Yes.
Yeah. That said, in the kind of the language of the scientific frontier, and this notion of this rationalization of geopolitical space in Afghanistan, you see, I think, some of the origins of what Pakistanis today describe as strategic depth. That is, the notion that Afghanistan is somehow part of a military strategy, which is interesting, I think. Civilians versus military. I would complicate that and say it's also civilians and military in certain different locations. So the civilians in London had a totally different concept of the problem to the civilians in Calcutta, and again in Ludhiana and other places too. The frontier era demonstrates, that said, a very interesting division between civilian forms of knowledge, which tended to be sort of political officers who weren't necessarily military, and then the kind of the more sort of powerful military science of the scientific frontier. And these two communities often get into fights with one another. And in that sense, yes, there is an enduring lesson there, but each of these communities have their own forms of knowledge that are overlapping. Sometimes one predominates over the other. There is a political struggle going on here, but what's interesting about that struggle is that it doesn't often pause and reflect on actually the people that they're talking about. It doesn't reflect on itself, if you like. And I think that if you want to draw a policy lesson, then that is something that perhaps needs to happen. We need to reflect on the knowledge that we generated and that we are treating as sort of sacrosanct. to the panel. I mean, thanks for all of your thoughts. As I said, I wish I could articulate what I'm doing as clearly. One of the things that we're doing here at LSC, Tarek's doing, George Lawson's doing, is inquiring into this history theory divide. And IR has often been castigated, often rightly so, for being overly theoretical, for beginning with theory and then going to history, to loot from history in order to prove theory. The other option there is to say, well, actually, maybe we need to do a better job of doing history, and that will allow us to interrogate the theory a bit better. But one of the really interesting things about this is that history emerges historically as well as theory emerges historically. So when we talk about questions such as how do we put together causal and constitutive arguments, that very division between a causal and constitutive worldview is in itself a product of history. That comes from history and a particular sociology of knowledge that says more about the discipline of IR than it does about the world out there, if you like. So that makes doing this work very complicated, because you've got theory moving through history as well as you've got history moving through history, if you like, and I'll come back to that point in a second. One of the things that I tried to do in the book is I don't really flesh it out in much detail, perhaps I need to do a better job in future, is talk about this idea of agnostic constructivism. That is the idea that we know that knowledge is derived from sort of social forms. We know that those social forms are unstable in a lot of times. So the job that we have as IR scholars is to try and understand that whatever historical moment, what certain disciplinary knowledge may actually be. That we need to historicize disciplinary knowledge first if we're going to do a better job of negotiating history and theory. The point on history has historical forms as well. I mean, I think, Rob, you've got a very useful observation. It comes back to Jonathan's remark that what about the Afghans themselves? What did the British mean to the Afghans? And as I said, it wasn't easy for me to access much of that, and as you said, the book is primarily about British representations of Afghanistan and how that shapes their worldview and their actions. The British often served a purpose. I think that is clear, and your work was, you know, really in the back of my mind when I was doing this research on how can we reconstruct what the Afghans may have been trying to achieve in their interactions. You used the example of Charles Matheson being sort of brought into the Afghan political community. As I recall, that was Taji Khan in Bamiyan, who was actually attempting his own kind of political movement against the then ruler Dost Mohammad Khan. So that would be an example of Afghans using kind of British knowledge against them, if you like, epistemic insurgency. The point on the Great Game, I mean... It wasn't meant personally.
No.
I should say that Rob Johnson was my tutor when I was doing my MPhil at Oxford. So, Rob, you only have yourself to blame.
Good on.
In the book, I say that that geopolitical rivalries are important, but they're not the only story. That this isn't a question of fact so much as emphasis. And I put the emphasis elsewhere because I think it has been understudied in part. And there's much more work to be done there than there is to be done on the geopolitical stuff. But then that raises the other question of what history is for. Is it to focus on the powerful and understand the powerful, or is it to understand how the powerful think about the less powerful, or even how the less powerful think about the powerful, as you're suggesting, if that's not too known unknown. what do we concentrate on? One of the things that I'm pointing to in the book is that we often concentrate on those things that we think are important in IR. That IR carries its own kind of theory-laden observations, and actually we need to disassemble those, to dissolve those, to do better history and theory within the discipline. I think think that's it. I mean, Duncan, you know, thank you for your comments. I think there is more work to be done in this area, particularly on the middle range intellectual history. And I was thinking of your kind of knowledge complexes idea in your international affairs article there. And there is actually a volume on Elphinstone coming out next year that Sharma currently is editing. So work to be done in this field is coming through.
I think one of the just very quick comment I'd make is look at the range of people that are interested in Martin's work. You know, IR theory, contemporary IR theory over here, the military history of empire over here, historian of political thought over here, all of whom are engaging with this text in pretty profound ways. So it gives you a sense of Martin's intellectual range and what his program is going to be like. Any of the panelists want to have a comment back?
I only thought, just out of courtesy, to answer very briefly the questions that were posed to all of us, because I think they're important. I mean, Jonathan, you're also an important point here, which is that there are three quick examples of where this happens. But one is monarchy, the extended discussions over 1919 at the end of the third Anglo-Afghan War. The Afghan bargaining position is if you push us too hard, monarchy will go and the communists will be in here. Works brilliantly well, the British comply. On the border one, again, classic one there, which goes to the third one, which is instability. Abdul Rahman Khan made a comment in 1896 to the British saying, your extension of roads into Waziristan up to what you call the Durand Line is actually like driving an auger, an owl, into my guts. The result of which can only be instability because an Afghan emir sleeps on an ant heap. And he was using this idea of the British extension of military control as a way of saying, you make me unstable, I know you're your buffer state, so watch it. So definite examples of where the Afghans were manipulating back against the British in a way to get their way. On the Durand Line, fantastic. Ahmad Siddiqui, a wonderful scholar who did a doctorate at Oxford recently, has written a brilliant exposition now, finally, of the Durand Line, really putting the final touches to our understanding of what was going on there from right way through, from the 1890s through to 1947 and beyond into the Soviet era in Afghanistan. Brilliant, I'd recommend that. And finally, on partition and division in Afghan society, very quickly respond to that comment, quite rightly made. Isn't it interesting that of all the countries in the region around Afghanistan, the only country without a separatist movement is Afghanistan? Does that tell you something? A friend of mine, Latif, said to me that Afghanistan is like a carpet of the Bukhara style. He says many weaves, many colours, and many fabrics within it, but only one carpet. And I think that's a lovely way of analogising what Afghanistan is. And that actually, it was the Soviet intervention which accelerated the divisions going on inside Afghan society in the late 1970s, which, to address your question, which have made the differences between Afghans so much more profound. So it wasn't really so acute, the definition of Afghans amongst themselves, to say, I am Pashtun Afghan, I am Tajik, I'm Hazara, I'm Afghan, if you like. Those divisions have been made more acute by that Soviet war, and they've gone on being perpetuated by the inability of that country to find its final political solution. And I think that's the only thing we can really say about it, is that the reason why we have this rather jaundiced view of Afghan history is because we're reading it back through the lens of 1978 through to the present.
Who's next?
That question.
About
Martin,
three comments.
Thank you. Congratulations on your success. Yeah. Actually, what prompted my hand to go up with the anthill remark just now. So, I guess just maybe more on that. Was there that kind of pushback within the policymaking community saying, if you conduct this activity, we are going to have this kind of problem in this region? To what degree? You sort of touched upon it between the military and civilians, and within the military and civilians and operating in different areas with different remits. And I guess if we were to draw a line to today, most of us came into our interest in this field in the aftermath of 9/11, the lead up to the Iraq War, the occupation of Afghanistan, now Syria. And in the 1.5 year lead up to the Iraq War, and just as an aside, within government, there has never been a greater body of people who are through the academic revolving door into government and then back,
many of whom have PhDs in these areas and will sit on panels like this, and everybody that should be a good thing. What I'm leading to is that should be a good thing. But when the Bush administration was leading up to the Iraq War, everyone in the whole three floors with PhDs at the CIA who were experts on the Middle East were vetted for their ignorance. Everyone in the State Department who was against it were vetted for their ignorance. And does that sort of thing infuriate the panel?
I saw a hand over here, please.
Hi, Martin. Congratulations once again. So my question is on the on sort of comparing the rate of advance of the frontier, because the frontier sort of rolled forward through your period of study, and at the rate at which, you know, and comparing that to the rate at which colonial notions, especially, you know, from Calcutta and Shimla, you know, advanced on what constituted, who constituted a nation, right? So because, you know, the Raj is dealing with many different potential peoples, you know, that there's principalities, there's states, you know, and I'm curious about the relationship with power. So in the sense, like, did the Afghans become a people in the minds of the British imagination because they could not be conquered? As opposed to, say, all of the other states in which, you know, the Raj manages to roll over and incorporate. And then so they're tabulated and categorized in a fundamentally different way. So again, the relationship between the exercise of power and the forms of categorization. Or was there always something distinctive about the way that the British looked at the Afghans, even before the border seemed to start to harden, you know, along what becomes the Durand line?
I'll take one more. Please.
I don't know whether you will like my question or not.
This is the best kind of question.
Our understanding is that most of the people, the public people in Afghanistan, not the military, rather, they are looking to the countries that have Afghanistan in a bad way. Because I'm sure you're following the events happening after 2001 in Afghanistan. The situation is deteriorating day by day. So do you think that the study you have done at that time and the situation that is going on now, do you think there is changes in the mindset of the policymaker in British or not? Because most of the people think that they are not, as my brother said, they are playing devil game while they are dealing with issues in Afghanistan. What is your recommendation?
Thank you. Martin?
Well, the last question first then. So contemporary resonance, I suppose, but I mean, what your question implies is that there is an Afghan attitude towards the international community, which is, you know, antithetical, you know, sort of annoyed, understandably so. I wouldn't say that this book directly explains that attitude because there's so much that happens in between. One thing I would say is that it's striking how a lot of the policies that were pursued post-2001 didn't seem to bring in much of this historical long view, that there didn't seem to be an appreciation of the deep grievances that exist within that country towards outside incursions, particularly in Helmand, interestingly. In fact, I remember a story about a NATO officer who was perturbed that an Afghan had come into the NATO headquarters and said, "You blew up my market." And he was, you know, very worried about some event that had occurred earlier that day, and it turned out he was talking about the storming of the 1842 Army of Retribution, which destroyed the market in Kabul. And that actually links to Stevie's question, I think, although you started off asking one question and then ended up asking a different one.
I wanted you to draw a line.
Okay, fine. there was apparently a number of historians prior to the 2001 intervention who said, wait a minute, this is a really bad idea. I think, I don't know if this is true, but McMillan apparently once said the first rule of politics is don't invade Afghanistan.
Don't march on Moscow and then don't head up there. Yeah.
Right. So one of the interesting things about the policy section of this book is that many of these policies were fiercely contested, often by those who claimed to have superior knowledge. Many of the knowledge entrepreneurs, as I termed them, when they became sucked up into a policy environment, disagreed with the policies that were being pursued for good reasons. Many of them, nonetheless, eventually rolled over. They had individual kind of career interests, I suppose, aspirations, things like that. But then there was also, you know, as I say in the book, you know, a process of closure. One of the most interesting things about doing the research for this book has been actually talking to members of the Foreign Office research analyst team who, and we've had long conversations, we often go around in circles about this, about at what point do your policies actually seriously take on, you know, intellectual research? And there doesn't seem to be much of an opening for that when you're dealing with major intervention decisions, which are predominantly, you know, they are wholly political decisions. We might make the same comment about the recent sort of upscaling of activity in Libya. Here you've got a great example of a desperately complicated political and social situation, which is being subject to a very blunt instrument of force. Surely there would be academic knowledge that could inform a better intervention there. I don't think that the Foreign Office and that the government in particular are interested in nuance in this area. Where academic knowledge comes in, I don't know. Maybe the other panelists have a better answer to that. The frontier rolled forward to a point, and also the concept of the frontier was actually quite vague in itself. The forward policy and the close border policy that's often talked about was in fact itself an ambiguity. Some people saw it in military terms, in terms of kind of frontier defence, garrisons, etc. Some people saw it in terms of land use practices. So you had highland communities who were subject to forward policies, and then you had lowland valley communities who were subject to close border policies. So I suppose there's something there in this sort of nexus between imperial power and the forms of knowledge that it generates. I mean, I wouldn't say that beyond the frontier there was just a big lump of Afghans. One of the difficult things about doing this research has been that the British actually had competing notions of what Afghan meant as well. Originally, it was primarily the Pashtun communities, but at some point that morphed into a more kind of holistic understanding. I don't think that probably really became thoroughly holistic until probably all of the borders have been defined, but that's beyond the scope of this project. So what the British did is when it suited their policy aims, they spoke about Afghans as a homogenous political community, and when they were seeking more nuanced kind of forms of policy intervention, they claimed to have a sort of a more granular perspective. This often happened with the frontier officers. But it was the interplay between these two kind of these more granular interventions and the more meta sort of statements of power that's really interesting and I don't think gets a lot of attention.
Thank you, Mark. You comments?
Well, I just think on your point about the when academic, you know, kind of interventions are made in policy, I think one of the answers to that is when it's bad academic work. I mean, so literally, I'm apologizing to be too cynical, but I mean, if you're Joseph Nye, you come up with an idea called soft power. If you're Huntington, you come up with a clash of civilizations, and people think, oh, that's cool, I can remember that, or whatever. And you know, and you have academic input into policymaking, potentially. I mean, whether that's how significant that is also up for grabs. So, it depends on what kind of academic work you're talking about.
Well, I don't even mean theoretically. I mean, I'm an expert on Iraq. I did my PhD there, and I know the society really well. This is a really bad idea if you engage in this. Get out of the room, you're sidelined.
Yeah.
Well, one of the
but that's not surprising, is it? Why is that surprising?
Right. One of the principal utilities of academics for policy is legitimation.
Yeah, exactly.
And if you're arguing something that's not helpful,
you know.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm pretty skeptical about the impact of academics, or at least the positive impact of academics.
Tell the government.
Luckily, I'm not impacted. It's got two different temporalities at work. I mean, it strikes me that the best kind of academic work is very slow, laborious, it's complicated, it's nuanced, it's subtle, it's everything that policy making isn't. Maybe it should be, but it isn't, and often in foreign policy and security situations, state implications of various kinds are what's essential. You know, every war there's been, there's academics in opposition to it, and you can always find House academics to be wheeled out to support it and legitimate it.
Yeah.
Expertise doesn't determine one way or another which way your political views are going to go. Mm-hmm. You know, Iraq experts were split over Iraq, you know, and that's going to be pretty much every war. So I'm skeptical. It doesn't point in one direction or another. It's ultimately up, I think, to your own political inclinations, how you think that your scholarship should be used. And even then, your scholarship may be used against you. I mean, plenty of critical theories being used by militaries, instrumentalised. You know, you can't really escape this power knowledge situation. So, yeah, I think I'm the other on this.
Mm.
Right. Well, very briefly, I mean, I think one of the things we need to be careful of is that we don't overload morally about decision makers and about decision making. I mean, it's been very easy over the conflict in Iraq and to some extent in Afghanistan to start to interpret decision makers somehow, or policy makers, as having a kind of almost evil intent now. It's got some almost absurd proportions of condemnation.
Mm.
And actually, we know that policy makers make judgments on very weak bases of knowledge.
Mm.
We have a moral duty. I think personally, we either ignore them and let them get on and make the mistakes on the basis of poor levels of knowledge, or we try and make some sort of intervention for the right reason and with good moral intent. And I think a lot of the violence that has occurred in Afghanistan, by Western forces, has been a result of exasperation, frustration in not understanding the region, and then finding resistance and having to, in that dynamic of once you use forces, a dynamic process goes on, it escalates, you want to sort of overcome the adversary, it's dynamic, and before you know it, you have a full-scale insurgency or counterinsurgency on your hand. And I think the only way of dealing with that is either, say, you ignore it or you engage in it in some way intellectually, you either criticise it from the outside or you try to get in the inside track and make some critical judgments, knowing full well you'll either be ignored or you'll be dismissed. But, I suppose the way I think about summing this up is that Smike Milligan, the British comedian who died many years ago now, wrote a book called Mussolini, His Part of My Downfall. I'm going to write a book called Rob Johnson, Mullah Omar, His Part of My Downfall, because I think that's what's happened to me. I think I'm clearly condemned by my colleagues for trying to intervene.
Yeah, you want to get in on that?
Yeah, it's just because it's very important, because it's a crowded audience, and I think this is a very important debate, which is, I totally accept Duncan's point about the different temporalities, and I agree with Tarak and others that very often policymakers may use academic work to legitimate the positions they want to take.
Mm.
But I absolutely endorse what Rob says, which I think there is a duty for academics who are interested in doing so to try and engage in policy debate. And I think one of the challenges we actually face is very often in some of these policy areas, which are quite sensitive policy areas, we don't actually have good visibility of the landscape of the debate or the extent of debate. And it is true that policymakers will grab an academic work to support what they want to say. But if you believe in what you're saying, and there is debate going on inside an administration, and so, for instance, we did some work around Taliban and the potential for reconciliation, which actually was critical in tipping British government policy towards trying to see if the 2013 negotiations could work, but they failed, as it turns out. Now, we didn't find out until about 2 years later that we had that impact. So I think there are potentials, but I also agree generally with the panel that you have to be fairly modest in your expectations as to how much impact you can have. And I also agree with Tarak, you've got to be aware of the kinds of dangers that your work will maybe misuse, that it will be used to legitimate. It's when there is debate, you have the potential to perhaps do
it. I think one of the things that unifies what Theo, Rob, and Martin are saying is that often in policymaking communities, there's a lot of division and debate going on. And one of the best ways to have an impact is to get inside that debate, pick the people that you have affinity with, and help them out, give them better arguments, talk to them about what you know. And then that's not you, the academic, coming up with the policy. That's you working with the policymakers to help get somewhere a little incremental. And that's not going to be an impact case either. But that's what I'd take
one point on that. I mean, I, just to be clear, I wasn't informing foreign policy.
But you started from the Afghan stuff.
Yeah. There was an Afghan studies group. I was interested in. Well, they were interested in engaging with more current research on Afghanistan, and so they said, do you know anyone who might be able to do that? They're apparently not interested in the 19th century. That said, I think that often, too often, the debate is stacked against academic research. I remember there was a panel at ISA a few years back where the panel was all about, oh, how you can tailor your research, or how you can get attention for your research from policymakers. And they were saying, what you need to do is write, ideally, one side, preferably half a side, ideally in bullet points, because these people are really busy, and if you do any longer than that, on a post-it note, if you do any more than that, you won't get any attention. And I just sort of think the policy world has to do a far better job of engaging with academic research if they think it's that simple.
Okay, I think it's time to give everyone a hand.